Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Well, welcome along to the Huddle Breakdown. It's been a while since all three of us have been on a call. James is with me. Hello.
Hello, Enda. You caught me off. That's not your normal intro. I went on mute.
Well, I'll bring in Alan now. Alan, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. This is very businesslike and brisk, isn't it, Enda? Because you're on your lunch hour.
Yeah, holy hell. I didn't. Okay. Totally different.
We see, normally I would have some sort of intro already ready to go and spill on about how we're top of the league again and things like that. But it hasn't really worked out for us very well when I've done that. So I've decided to go straight into the podcast, straight into the action. And it has nothing to do with the fact that I'm doing this while on my lunch break and only have about 40 minutes of it left to do. So these are the joys of trying to get three people who live on three different parts of the planet together to do a podcast at the same time. So apologies that it has been a bit chock-a-block over the last couple of weeks and there hasn't been a consistent level of all three of us being on the podcast, but we're here now and we're going to be looking back at Celtic's win at the weekend. I know it's a while since that game happened, but we do have loads of stats and loads to talk about on that. And we're also going to touch a little bit, and I mean a little bit, on the refereeing situation in Scotland as well. So guys, where do we want to start? I will throw this out there. During the weekend, I think it was probably the first time, James, and I don't know how long, probably since at least January, that I genuinely thought Celtic played quite well without too many grievances about the performance overall.
Agree. It was a refreshing and enjoyable game to watch. And I thought getting more than functional wing play was delightful and a key part of that, particularly, you know, with the first goal. And yeah, just overall, you know, with Carter Vickers back in the side and Kuhn kind of stepping up to the level that was hoping that he'd be at, you know, those kind of things. And then, you know, it speaks to how when you just have a couple of key parts that are able to function at the level that's required. It was just refreshing. And I think, you know, as they say, it's the hope that kills. So I think there's some renewed hope in that regard. And I'll maybe after Alan takes his view, I'll circle back onto why, you know, there might be some caution relative to the game. And I'll get into that in a little bit. But yeah, you know, that's on the margin. Generally speaking, I thought there was a lot to be encouraged about. Mm.
I mean, Alan, that is true. I mean, like, there's obviously, we can nitpick about certain aspects of certain parts of the game, but overall, considering how Celtic have been playing over the last number of months, it's very hard to be overly critical of their performance against St. Johnstone.
Yeah, I think it's closer to a 90-minute performance, but still quite a long way short of a 90-minute performance. But I agree with both of you that I was generally happy with it as well. Even that first 20 minutes where didn't have a single shot at goal at all, actually. I wasn't panicking. I wasn't worried, wasn't concerned. It looked like we were moving the ball quickly. It looked like we were getting finding spaces. It looked like we were getting players into good positions to attack. And, you know, we were up against what was, and I know James will get into St. Johnstone's shape, but it was essentially a 5-4-1. Low block. It was 9, if not 10 players, as we said before the pod, really, that's likely how it was going to go. So, you know, once we started to get pressure on their goal. And as I say, it took 20 minutes for Carter Vickers to have a header over the bar from a corner. You know, it was good in terms of the penetration. It was another game with plus four XG for. I suppose if we're being pernickety, it kind of went a little bit awry after Carter Vickers went off, which I think was one of those situations where Rodgers did the right things for the right reasons, but sometimes it doesn't work, right? And he did, you know, quite late on, he brought on Lagerbielke, which obviously is going to be a substitution of last resort, it would appear, to sort of shore things up at the end kind of thing. But, you know, not the need shoring up as such, but, you know, St. John, I think this is where, and maybe get diving into the detail a little bit here, but just as it's in my mind, that substitution and that management of the game at that point was one of those occasions where I'm thinking, there's like a Chris Davis-sized gap here in terms of reading the game, reading the momentum of the game. Because St. Johnstone had brought on Stevie May, who, Stevie May's not a great player, but he's industrious, he pressurizes defenders, he runs the channels well, etc. And it was really him that was the catalyst for St. Johnstone to have that little flurry around almost immediately once the substitution of Carter Vickers had been made, really. And you'd sort of thought, yeah, that's the sort of thing that Chris Davis was really good at spotting and nipping in the bud before it happened. But these are small details in relative terms. I agree that in the terms of direction of travel, this was a good attacking performance against a poor team, obviously, for sure. But listen, we've played good teams, poor teams all season, and we focus on the performance, and this was a good performance overall, I think.
I know this is one of the ones that's a little bit harder to quantify in terms of stats, but in terms of the speed of play that Celtic are playing, and the intensity of play is probably a better way to phrase that, because I know you've focused on the quickness and how we're trying to get the ball forward. But in terms of just the intensity that Celtic are playing at the minute, there definitely does seem to be a little bit of a kick up the arse over the last number of weeks, especially with the wingers, especially with the likes of Kuhn. Alistair Johnson is getting more involved with the attack, and we seem to be more direct in the sense of when we get the ball, we're not taking 3 to 4 seconds to decide what we're going to do with it. There seems to be a little bit more intensity here, James, that Celtic are playing at.
I think a lot of that just has to do with the personnel, and this goes back to these seminal pieces that when they're not there, as Alan referenced, things kind of went to hell a little bit on the margin when Carter Vickers went off, and then you had Riley go out late, and all sensible, like that's the whole point. Like, the game was relatively well at hand. The likelihood of St. Johnstone being able to pull back 2 or even 3 goals is almost zero. It's not impossible, but even if you put in, the Celtic B team, that would be probably unlikely. particularly within a 15, 20 minute stretch. So I did things deteriorate? Was it noticeable? Yes. Was it still probably the smart thing to do? I think yes, because, we cannot afford to lose some of these guys to any kind of material injury for 2 or 3 weeks even. I don't think the way we're playing has shifted all that much. I just think, Kuhn has blossomed a bit, and Carter Vickers is so important to that. And the ability of those two players, along with Kyogo back in the side, I think, and I'll get into this in a little bit, as well as what St. Johnstone did to make a lot of this stuff easier. I think that's what made it look like we were more effective in playing the way that I think we've pretty much been trying to play. It's just, it came off a lot better for a myriad of reasons for, let's call it 70 minutes on the weekend.
It's a bit of a puzzle fitting everything in together, Alan, and it's very hard to say that one thing is the cause of another. But if you look at the better performances that Celtic have, obviously, defensively, Carter Vickers makes a difference. But in terms of what Carter Vickers does to Alistair Johnson's performance in terms of the security of going forward and getting involved in the play a bit more, I think if you really dug down into the games, and I'm just doing this offhand, off memory, but this season, when Alistair Johnson has played well and when the right winger tends to play well, when Alistair Johnson plays well, and Alistair Johnson tends to play better when Carter Vickers is the starting centre back. So do we feel like it's probably those, for those types of reasons, that they have been getting better, that they suddenly have the stronger players back, which obviously makes a difference, but that might have been some of the issues as well earlier in the season, that the players who make other players better weren't available, therefore they looked a little bit more ordinary.
It isn't complicated at the macro level. You need good players and you need them to play well. And if you've got lots of good players and they play well, you're going to generally beat most opponents, right? And in Celtic's case, that's what, you know, you want to get your best players and you want them playing well. In terms of diving into more micro level, it can be very fragile. As we've seen, that works both ways, as in, you know, we've seen Kyogo struggle to get on the end of chances that he, you know, the type of chances just not being created like they were last season. XG is down, the quality XG per chance is down. Where you just, you know, look at the shot maps, shows you we're just not getting those, he's not getting those kind of 6-yard penalty box finishes that he was last season. And then suddenly it looks like he's got a relationship on the field with Kuhn. And that changes the dynamic, and that's like a one thing. And suddenly, your most effective attacker looks more effective. And you know, Kyogo had a great game at the weekend. He obviously got his goal and his assist. He was over two in expected scoring contributions, etc. So, and he looked to have that. The ultimate barometer with Kyogo is having that smile on his face, and that was there. And I think it was just simply, you know, as James mentioned, Kuhn has flourished in the last couple of games. And, I should say, by the way, you know, hands up, right? Both James and I last week, you weren't there, Ender, were adamant that we had to play Ida against St. Johnson as his attributes were better served to breaking down St. Johnson than Kyogo. So absolutely delighted to hold my hand up and say got that one wrong. Little things like that. And then, as you say, with Alistair Johnson, I mean, Alistair Johnson's has hit over the last 4 to 5 matches an extraordinary level of performance, actually. And then we can maybe go into that in a bit more detail, but some of his data points have doubled in terms of his prior average to his average over the last 5 games. And some of that is having Carter Vickers there. Some of it's just vagaries of form, similar to Maeda. I mean, Maeda, for all, you know, people joke about his inscrutability and the way he looks, he's actually a really streaky player. In terms of, you know, he seems to be a real confidence player, and he's either in form or he's not. And when he's in form, he's positive, he's driving past the fullback, he's taking people on, he's being aggressive in his movements with the ball. He's always aggressive out of possession, but I'm talking about when he's got the ball. And then when he's not in form, he's just very circumspect and very safe in everything that he does when he gets the ball. So, you know, that's another thing that has changed in the last few games, and that is that, you know, that aspect of play, and that, and as I say, if that wing play starts to become coherent, then suddenly Celtic are a very different team to what we saw earlier in the season. So it can be many things, but it doesn't have to be a lot, if you see what I mean. It can be lots of little things. That's how fragile form is and cohesion is, really. You know, if we were to model cohesion, I would suggest it's the difference in shape between it being effective and it being not effective would be a very small area of the graph.
Mm. Well, I think that's what's frustrating about maybe analysing Celtic on a week-to-week basis, is that a lot of the time it's very hard to tell what the causation of this is. Is it the fact that Johnson just wasn't playing well, he just didn't have confidence, or was it down to Carter Vickers being out injured? It's always usually a combination of all the factors, but just from a viewer's perspective, it's impossible to tell without actually being part of the camp. But I mean, James, like I said this a couple of weeks ago, and then Celtic were awful the following week, but it does seem that going into the very, very important part of the season, probably the title decider in a couple of weeks' time, that Celtic's good players seem to be playing better, and the players that were underperforming seem to be slightly on the upward curve in terms of like Kun, Maeda starting to score goals again, Kyogo, who was out of form, starting to score again, Carter Vickers is back, Alistair Johnson seems to be playing a little bit better. I mean, like, it's no longer, it doesn't seem, at least in the short term, and the St. Johnson game in particular, that it's all down to Matt O'Reilly playing well or not.
Yeah, I think this is where, you know, it's probably a good segue to get into some of the stuff I prepared on opposition. Because as I always say, when you're analyzing these games, it takes two to tango, styles makes fights, all these things. And, you know, there's a certain basket of metrics that I look at game to game when I compare games and kind of stylistically how the opposition sets up, you know, formation being one of it. But, you know, as we know, those are kind of fluid. So a couple of them are, you know, defensive line, or you know, average defensive action. And that's basically if you take the 102 or 105 meters and you scale to 100, there's a metric that says, okay, the average engagement was defensively was 30 meters or it was 45 meters. And, you know, to give you an idea, Celtics are usually up close to 50 domestically because, you know, a lot of our defending occurs, you know, as we squeeze the game playing the high line with center backs. You know, a team that bunkers, like really bunkers, let's call it the St. Mirren model against Ange Ball, that's kind of in that 28 to 30. That's the metric. So that gives you an idea of what we're dealing with here. And again, to put more context on that, Ange Ball against Real Madrid was 42 in this metric. Rodgers Ball against Atletico Madrid was 35. So again, you kind of get a sense of the style of play here and how this kind of reference point. The second one is something called aggression. And this has to do with within 2 seconds of the receipt of a pass, does the opposition tackle, press, or foul? And there's various ways to measure this. So these are two ways that I kind of, you know, take a look at how is the opposition actually set up to defend. And what I would say, that mix for St. Johnston manifested exactly what Alan and I hoped for we might see more of in January and February, which is the opposition says, hey, these guys aren't what they usually are. Let's go after them a little bit, right? And that's, I think, you know, whereas, you know, Alan and I talked about the expectation of Levine setting up to play Levine Ball, which is deep block, bunkered, and kind of narrow. He actually didn't really do that within the scale of, you know, the Levine world. So his line was actually, you know, that metric was up closer to 35 for the defensive distance. And the big one was the aggression. They were far more aggressive than what, you know, Levine's team usually are against Celtic. And quite frankly, you know, I talk about formulas, like how do teams have these formulas to give us problems? And they tend to be some mix of either deep and not overly passive or push the line up a little bit, but not be too aggressive. You know, so when Motherwell gives us problems, they have a line that's a little higher, but they're not crazy in pressing the ball on and being ultra aggressive. Because if you think about this again, just commonsensically, when you have the superior team, the superior talent, and you know, hopefully, usually the superior athleticism, that aggression creates movement and then space so that when a guy beats a guy or there, even there's just some chaos, that makes them more vulnerable to transition and our attack with the superior talented players. And so I think Levine, and again, to put this in proportionality, so I wrote down some of these numbers, right? So Motherwell on November 25th, and I think we that was the late goal that we scored, I think, when, you know, they kind of dragged the game out and O'Reilly had a late game goal to win 2-1 away to Motherwell. Their aggressive actions for that game was 80. Okay, and their score for aggression was like 10% of the time that they actively engaged our pass recipients within 2 seconds. St. Johnson's scores was 153 and 20% of the time. They were double. You just don't see that mix against this level of opposition. So I think, you know, when Al and I said Ida was a better matchup, that was with the idea that they were going to do the Levine and bunker and play like the St. Mirren model, which is 5-4-1, deep low block, close the space, tighten it up. And actually, if you look at the game, they were trying to squeeze the game with their lines being relatively tight, but they were doing it 10 or 15 yards higher up, or at least trying to. And that lends itself to exactly what happened, which was Kyogo getting in behind. Like, the problem with Kyogo playing against the deep block is, you know, obvious. So I think the tactics that Levine came out with relative to how we actually did our selection made it, you know, a very friendly game to us in that kind of aspect. So again, none of this has anything to do with the idea that we didn't play well or that there aren't these, you know, very positive things going on. It's the question of how does this manifest, relatively speaking, against a team that does bunker? Because I don't think that's what St. Johnson did, which again, at Celtic Park, makes what he did even crazier.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, there are always two teams on the pitch, and we focus mainly on Celtic a lot of the time, but it does impact the way that they play, and it does impact the way the Celtic play. It certainly felt like there was a lot of space. We even saw some of the old Kyogo staying offside until the second phase of play a couple of times, which is something you're seeing more and more of now in mainstream football, which it was great to see Kyogo back at that. But in terms of the defence, Alan, there was one key factor that was clearly missing from Celtic's defence, and that was Liam Scales, who was out injured. He's missing Ireland's match this weekend as well, so I don't know if that means it's just a precautionary thing, but he still is injured for the short term. What impact did that have? And let's actually talk about Liam Scales in a more mature way than we normally do, because normally it's just a little tongue-in-cheek back and forth, but if we could, we now know what Celtic looked like without him in the team, and we didn't previously. So was there any really recognizable differences?
Well, you know, I think with Scales, the main issue is one where there is not really the data that's easily to hand, which is that what you referenced earlier, and about just how many milliseconds does it take to recycle the ball. Because in terms of, if we were to compare him to, say, Stephen Welsh, a lot of his defensive frailties, Scales, are very similar. Welsh has the same issues, mainly around his lack of aerial ability to win duels consistently, or even win duels cleanly, should I say, more accurately. And actually, over the season, Scales has the highest pack passing score in the squad, slightly ahead of Welsh. Now, what you have to appreciate is that, you know, Scales has had a settled run of 30 odd games, 90 minutes. Welsh, as we know, barely plays 90 minutes, 90 minutes in a row. So if Welsh were to get a run in the team, I suspect he would improve on that, be my feeling. But I can't say the data shows me that today on the limited data I have for Welsh for this season. But I did, whether it was my bias, I did feel that we just moved the ball from centre-back a little bit quicker. We certainly got the ball out to the wings and had joy. And to James's point, whilst I accept, you know, everything that he said correctly about their starting position and so forth, the other aspect I would say is that they played quite a narrow four in midfield. They were trying to get support to the guy up front, Sidibe, to be fair to them, and they strung five across the back, and it meant that all of those things actually were wise if you consider how Celtic have struggled this season in terms of creating from wide areas. You know, the feeling that Celtic aren't really that coherent, so why not, we might as well give it a go in terms of pressing. All of that makes perfect sense, right? But unfortunately, it didn't work for St. Johnson, probably because they haven't got that, you know, good enough players. And actually, it meant that the two fullbacks had, you know, great days, really, productive days, as did the two wingers. because Celtic were able to overload those wide areas and have space in behind to run. So sorry, that was just on the St. Johnstone, how they set up, etc. But I just wanted to come back to Scales then. No, I did do a deep dive on Scales, and it's on the Celtic Way, because as you say, we joke about it a lot, and you know, I know that I was very aware of having a go at Scales a couple of weeks ago when he had. It was a poor game. He had a very poor game. But to be fair, it was out of character with how he'd played most of the season. So it was an exception. Although, if you actually look at his form, it had been dipping. Now, the fact that he's now got injured sets alarm bells ringing to me that perhaps that, you know, that injury has been coming, if you like, in terms of just stresses and strains. He's played something like 35, 90 minutes in a row. So, but anyway, to give him his due, I wanted to give him a proper assessment and really profile him sort of properly. I started off a little bit cheekily by comparing him to John Souter, because you can't actually compare Celtic players to any other players in the league other than players from the Rangers, because frankly, you know, those two teams are so dominant. Comparing him to a Dundee defender is just pointless. The data is meaningless, virtually meaningless, unless you possession adjust it all. And even then, it's you're possessing adjusting, you know, apples and oranges, really. So he actually profiles, I would say, without getting into too much detail, he actually profiles probably better than Souter in a lot of areas. Not in aerial dominance, obviously, but certainly in a lot of the passing and even the overall defensive action type statistics. Scales, you know, does profile well. And if you profile Scales against the population of historical Celtic centre backs, he's not in that left hand corner of sadness. You know, he isn't. He's not there with the worst centre backs we've seen. You know, the sort of Jack Henrys, the Effie Ambrose of the last few years. He's kind of average. And actually, that's a real win for him. If you were eighth choice, and actually you've proven to be in the same sort of ballpark as players like Sviatchenko, you know what I mean? Players that we think of as probably, yeah, he did a decent job. They weren't great, but he did a good, decent job, you know. I think I'm not damning with faint praise. I think that's a good place for Liam Scales to be. And so probably not where we would expected him to be when we first started. As I mentioned, his packing passing scores are the highest in the squad. And, you know, he averages over 90 odd passes a game, etc. So, you know, he does well in that regard. Obviously, the downside is that he, you know, as the tall defender, as the tallest of the defenders, he's not aerially dominant. And that is a reoccurring, you know, issue with Celtic defenders as a whole. And then, you know, again, we come back to that whole sort of speed of play.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Which I think is the main issue. It's if you're going to be playing in a team like Celtics, it's important that you move the ball quickly. I was just checking my data there. His profile for this season matches almost precisely. This is defensively, not any other aspect. Just defensively, profiles almost exactly the same as Jason Denier. And we remember Jason Denier quite fondly as being Van Dyke's partner, but then Van Dyke was dominant in every aspect of the game, and Denier was like the sweeper-upper, whereas we're looking for Scales to be the dominant one in terms of defensive actions. And I think that's the context that's key here. So he's certainly not the worst centre-back that we've had. And as I say, I'm not trying to damn him with faint praise on that one. He's nowhere near... But the problem with Scales, or the problem that Scales has, it's not the problem with Scales. Scales is what he is. Is that he's the lightning rod for everything that was wrong with recruitment, because he's been asked to do a job through a combination of bad luck and bad recruitment. He's done that job. He's probably exceeded expectations, and yet he still isn't at the level that, let's call it the Carter Vickers benchmark, that we probably need to see to be being more competitive in Europe and in being comfortably ahead in the SPFL. And it's very much what he's not. And that's not his fault. I feel, that's not his fault. I think he's done the absolute best he can with what he's got. And as I say, he's not the worst that we've ever had. He's just a little bit in the wrong time in the wrong place. But he's probably, this has probably set him up for, if he does move from Celtic, he's probably set him up for a decent next step. And I'm disgusted he's not playing for Ireland. It'd be great to see him build his international career. So that was more of a, hopefully, a bit more of a rounded, balanced view of Scales.
I'm going to come.
Go on.
Yeah, I'm going to come in now because I've been his PR man all season, and it's been a bit of a running joke on the podcast. But I agree completely with your assessment there, and I know that's sort of based on the numbers aspect. But I guess the one of the reasons that I have my backup mainly about not being protective of Liam Scales, because he's not my relation or anything like that, but being protective over how good or bad he is because I think the biggest issue with Liam Scales is one of perception. And the perception has always been that Liam Scales is not good enough for Celtic, that he's an Aberdeen player at best, that he's the type of player that will get your manager sacked, that he is only good enough for the low levels of Scotland, that he'll never be good enough for Celtic. And I always felt that no matter what he did, he was never ever going to be given the recognition that he deserved, or even recognized as an average player like the numbers seem to suggest, because as soon as he has a bad performance or a string of worse performances than playing out of his skin, then people will immediately jump back to he was never good enough, this is the problem with recruitment, it's all down to the board, sack the board, sack Scales, he's everything that's wrong with the club. So that's what pissed me off most about Liam Scales, is that he was never going to get a free run in the same way that a new signing might. If you brought in, let's say, people were still screaming for Lager Bielke, and he's clearly not good enough because the manager he's had chances, the manager doesn't think he's good enough, and yet people were still screaming his name as if he was the savior. And I always just thought that if Liam Scales had come from the Swedish league or the Polish league for £2 to £3 million, and he played the way he played this season, the perception of his season and the perception of him as a player would have been completely different to the fact that he was an eighth choice centre back who was brought in by, let's just say, it was definitely a board member, because that's what it seems like, and he was brought into the team because of injuries. And he fought his way back into the team. That really bugged me that nobody could ever give him his dues, and that they were almost always waiting for him to fail. And I don't think you should want a Celtic player to fail at any point in time to suggest that your biases might actually end up being the correct ones. So that's where I fall in names, because I think he has outshone his expectations. I think he's probably reached the peak of what he's going to reach. I don't think he's going to kick on and become a Cameron Carter-Vickers, and that's fine. I'm happy with the way that Liam Scales has developed. And James, I think he's probably going to sign a new Celtic deal, but if he didn't sign a new contract with Celtic, he would probably end up somewhere in the lower to mid-tier of the Championship.
I think that, and I'd be curious to hear what Alan's take on this is. I think he actually comps very well with Starfelt, and the disparity in narrative between the two could not be more stark. You know, this goes back to what we always talk about, and you know, how our bias is always, us included, wreak havoc on us. And so what I've been wrong on and happy to have been wrong on is I expected him to have a, I'll call it adverse profile, similar to Starfelt, meaning that, you know, more of the doozies, the surrendering possession horribly, you know, these error rates and turnover rates where you set up the opposition on a counterattack, that type of thing. He's actually been materially lower than Starfelt in that regard. And the other thing that has been, he's been significant, well, there's two other things he's been materially better than Starfelt. One is ball progression. So to Alan's point, not only on pack passing, but his ability to carry the ball and how it kind of ends up when he does carry it, he's been better than Starfelt. And the other thing is that, you know, and a lot of this was not all that dangerous because he did it in the, you know, the attacking half, but Scales fouls a lot less than Starfelt did. And, you know, that has a risk and reward, meaning that that was, you know, how Ange wanted Starfelt playing, kind of diving in to try and keep the pressure on, squeeze the game in the attacking half. But that also, you know, manifests in the defensive half as well, and conceding free kicks, and you know, we know that's a general weakness. So his, Scales' foul rate's actually been about half of Starfelt. They both suffer the same affliction, which is neither of them were or generally are that press resistant. So this again comes back to the issue of how does it scale to Europe, pun intended, is, you know, if they're confronted with a very organized athletic press, they deteriorate to a point where you're like, okay, you know, all of those issues that we're comfortable with on the ball progression side and possession can quickly descend into bad things. So I think domestically for Celtic, similar to Starfelt, he's adequate. And, you know, as I would call it, a replacement level, I would actually argue on the margin, he's probably been better than Starfelt. All in. And I, again, a lot of this season he's been playing with not Carter-Vickers next to him. And, you know, so that's a huge part of this is he's been able to produce at a very comparable level to Starfelt, not having that bedrock next to him. And so I think that's, you know, he's deservedly getting the praise that he gets. With that context.
Yeah, I think just to finish up on it, and I swear I'll get off my high horse after I finish this point, but
no one believes that.
I would love to see I would like to have seen Liam Scales play in the Ange ball system. Like the Liam Scales of this season, slot him into where Starfelt is with how dominant Celtic were and how good they played to see where he looks or what he looks like. And this is where the high horse comes in. I think despite most of the fan base and a large minority of the fan base being obsessed with the fact that so many of the Lisbon Lions grew up around Celtic Park and the homegrown talent, there is a little bit of a snobbishness around I know Liam Scales isn't homegrown because he didn't come through the academy, but homegrown players that are already at the club coming through. I think it's probably a symptom of modern football that a new signing from a foreign league is always better than a player who's at your club breaking through. And I'd like to see where the people who bang on about the fact that the academy aren't producing players anymore fall in the people who didn't like David Turnbull, don't like Liam Scales, hate James Forrest with a passion, wouldn't be a big fan of some of the younger players coming through. You know, I'd love to see the overlap, the Venn diagram of how many people fall into the same circle. I just think, yeah, there's always going to be that, especially with modern football. And I think Liam Scales, unfortunately, is a victim of some of that snobbishness as well. But we'll park that because I have about 10 minutes left of my lunch break and we still haven't touched on the refereeing scenario. So the plot thickens in the refereeing situation in the Scottish League. Crawford Allen has resigned or is going to resign as the head of the SFA. And if you read the reports by some of the journalists in Scotland at the minute, it isn't something that came entirely voluntary. So Alan, this is a very interesting progression in the VAR's SFA refereeing situation here.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say Celtic have been taking notice of refereeing performances, especially since VAR has been in operation, because actually, A, you've got a lot more officials involved, and B, despite what we might think, is that there is actually more now transparency in terms of how decisions are being arrived at, because there's like a sequence of events sometimes. A decision is made on the field, then there's a review, then there's another decision. So you've got more data, I guess, to work with, right, is what I'm saying. And listen, you know, VAR has, let's be honest, VAR has taken time to settle in most countries. Most countries have had difficult bedding in periods. I think it was particularly rushed in Scotland, and for probably not the best reasons, i.e. it was more protectionist on behalf by the SFA to protect the skill set and competency of their officials vis-a-vis getting them selected for European competition, i.e. being competent in the use of VAR, than it was about optimal timing for the benefit of Scottish football. But that's classic SFA, looking after themselves, not thinking about the good of the game. And therefore, because it was rushed in and you're rushing it in using part-time referees, then there's a potential there for it to not go smoothly. And I think that's probably most people's experiences of it. Then you have to layer in what has been, you know, some of the patterns of usage over since VAR was in the public domain. That got most traction. The issue that got most traction was, you know, the Rangers' fantastical 75 match league run without conceding a penalty. What people sometimes forget is that run was preceded, you know, there was a little run where they conceded four penalties in about 2 to 3 months or something. And then prior to that, there was a 44-match league run where they didn't concede a penalty. And that run started almost precisely the day Crawford Allen started as head of refereeing operations at the SFA. Similarly, believe it or not, the lack of red cards. Yeah, so when the Rangers were first promoted and they were kind of, you know, trying to get what Dave King called the solid second, that was their kind of goal, and they were battling it out for third place with Aberdeen, they actually had a tremendous number of red cards, something like 19 in the first two or three seasons the new club got promoted to the Premier League. And then again, that same, more or less the same group of players suddenly didn't get any red cards at all for a huge amount of time. And that run started pretty much on the day that Crawford Allen was appointed head of refereeing service. These are all coincidences, I'm sure. They're not patterns of assistance at all. So Crawford Allen is under scrutiny, and as you say, is resigning. Reading between the lines, it's probably not voluntary. In classic SFA style, rather than just binning him, it's like delay it to the end of the season so the good old boy can find his next role, etc. So it's all, you know, look after your mates and all that stuff. We know that's the culture. I think it's fair to say, and I'll tread carefully here, it's fair to say Celtic have taken an interest in these trends and patterns. And specifically the Hearts game, where we know that essentially turned on two VAR interventions, and they were interventions. Essentially, John Beaton re-refereed the game on behalf of Don Robertson, with the Yang sending off and with the awarding of a penalty against Iwata. Neither one decision, the penalty, was just ludicrous given the context of the handball decisions that had been made the season previous, the meetings that had been held, the reset on the handballs, and we seem to have moved on to a more sensible place. That was a throwback to last season, where it's like, depending on the context and depending on the team, perhaps, if the ball hits you anywhere in the hand of the area, it's a penalty for some teams, not others. And that we seem to be a throwback to that. It was just a ludicrous decision. But the one I think that exercised Celtic's mind is the Yang one, because whatever you might think, I think you could just get three referees to look at that Yang where he raised his foot and Cochrane came charging in with his head. One referee might give nothing. One referee might give a yellow, one referee might give a red. It's a very subjective call. The purpose of VAR is not to trump one person's subjectivity with another. It's to say, have you made a clear and obvious error? It wasn't a clear and obvious error for Don Robertson to issue a foul and to book Yang. Now, how that decision was arrived at and how John Beaton got Robertson's attention and got him to change his mind, I don't know, but my reading of it is that there may be something in there that has caused some consternation as regards processes and procedures. And Celtic feel they've got a strong case in terms of the charge that Rodgers has been put on as regards his comments about the refereeing being incompetent. And Celtic will be defending that very, very vigorously. And it's surprising, astonishing almost, that Allen has been forced to resign in advance of that. That disciplinary hearing. So there's a lot going on there. And listen, you know, what I wanted to do really was, rather than just be another one of those pods that complains about referees all the time, I think a more positive way to think about this going forward, and as I say, I think there's a lot more to come on this, by the way, is you know, what can we do about it? And I want to refer people to an excellent piece on the Sentinel Celts .com. So Sentinel, S-E-N-T-I-N-E-L, Celts.com. Maybe, Enda, you can put a link in the blurb on YouTube after this. SentinelCelts.com, resolution on refereeing standards. So what the guys and gals at Sentinel Celts are encouraging small shareholders to do is to get behind a resolution for the AGM to propose a way forward to enhance the quality of refereeing in Scottish football. And I just want to very quickly go through, because this is really very much aligned to my thinking on this. It's just that, you know, they've actually gone to the trouble of putting it on paper, for which I'm very grateful, not something I hadn't previously done. And it's really just to think about how business operates in general. There's nothing revolutionary here if you've ever operated in a business environment where you have to deal with vendors and clients and service providers. It's to really, you know, think of refereeing as a service. And that's how the English FA treats it. It is a service, that the service is the provision of refereeing expertise to the Football League, to the Premier League. And if you think about that in terms of how would that change the relationship, it's really moving away from the SFA being master of all, which is absolutely appropriate if you're setting standards for safeguarding grassroots kids' football, or setting up, you know, standards that academies must meet to reach certain statuses. These are all jobs that the SFA are, you know, competent and should be doing. But when it comes to professional football, at the moment, they have absolute end-to-end control over refereeing services, you know. And the problem with that, as well as it not conforming to a service model, which I'll come to, is I come back to our friend Crawford Allen and his unfortunate patterns under his watch, is that there is far too much power in that role, because essentially that head of refereeing operations has got ultimate sign-off of the recruitment, the training, the assignment, the monitoring, the scoring, the promotion, the demotion, the recommendation for who gets a UEFA or a FIFA assignment, all of that. And there isn't sufficient separation of duties there to have adequate controls to stop bad things from happening. And it looks like bad things have been happening, let's be honest about it. So back to a service model. A service model really starts to split out some of these roles and responsibilities. The refereeing service, which the SFA can still own a large chunk of, should absolutely be responsible for identifying and recruiting people to be referees, providing a standard set of FIFA-approved training modules and so forth, and then for even assigning them because you don't really want the league to be assigning people to games. You want a, you want some neutrality and assignment of referees. But really, that that should be the kind of the end of the SFA's involvement. What then the league should do is they should in they should have agreed a set of criteria with the SFA for how do we evaluate performance? How are we going to score and monitor and appraise these referees? And it should be the league's job to do that. And then, you know, everybody comes together and says, well, how are we doing? Are we meeting our standards? And if we're not meeting our standards and the league don't feel that they're getting the services that they that a fully professional football league deserves, then they should have the right to be able to go somewhere else to get services from somebody else. If another FA or another body wants to provide refereeing services out with the controls of the Scottish Football Association, that should be something that the Scottish leagues should be able to do. So it's all about, but this also it protects the referees as well in many respects, because they are beholden to their customer and to the satisfaction of their performance to their customer. And I don't mean favouring one team over another. It's got to be across, you know, all the teams and all the leagues that they officiate in, etc. So, but there's nothing in any of what I've said that is remotely revolutionary. If you have, as I say, ever worked in business and ever worked with service providers, with clients and so forth. But that, to me, would allow refereeing to be on a more professional basis, on a more risk-averse basis in terms of separating elements of control and command appropriately, putting the onus on the SFA as a not as the master, but as the service provider, and the football league as being the customer, as being the client, and therefore having a much higher say in, you know, are we meeting the standards that we all need to meet? So get over to Sentinel Cells. If you're a small shareholder, please, there's instructions there for how to sign up to agree to this resolution. I think they need 100 signatories on it. Apologies if I've got that wrong, for it to, you know, be considered by the company secretary for discussion at the AGM. So to me, this is a really positive and common sense, if you like, step for how refereeing could be improved.
Yeah, I'll put the link of that into the description. I'll drop it in the comments as well whenever this video is live. I think that's interesting. I've never actually thought of that too much, but I'm surprised that so far, given the level of player power and the way that agents have changed the shape of the game from the clubs holding all the power within the players to the players holding all the power, that referees haven't got together and essentially made themselves private contractors and worked that way. And they were, you know, you still have to do your badges, you still have to pass the procedures, but ultimately it would be a meritocracy of who gets the biggest games, because the league would hire you as opposed to the FA and the SFA and whoever actually organizing. It's an interesting thought. That's my understanding of what they're putting forward. Is that correct?
And it's the service model. It's really a service model, I guess. But you're right. I think if you extend that forward, why don't we have a situation where, and let's just take a scenario, you have a referee in England who doesn't feel that he or she is getting the big games in the English Premier League, feels that they're, you know, the scores are good, but whether it's the manager doesn't like them or whatever, they're not getting on. Apply for a job in Scotland. You could be the top ref in Scotland. You know, that might have as much cachet as being the seventh best referee in the EPL. Do you know what I mean? So that sort of scenario. I mean, why isn't there more? Why isn't somebody in France who wants to be a referee coming over, you know, wanting to live in Scotland and being a referee? There should be more of that sort of thing. Absolutely. But you know, we know that the SFA are still locked into the 17th century. And as regards their recruitment processes, they're probably not much more, they're probably not much have more foresight in terms of thinking about who they can recruit into those roles.
I can't wait for the deadline day sticker that has the transfers of referees to to certain leagues and people giving out that, you know, the Scottish teams, their bargain basement transfers of referees into the league is what's holding it back over the next couple of years. But that we will touch on that again, I'm sure, as the story develops. But that is all I have time for. That's all we have time for here on the Huddle Breakdown, because my lunch break is now over. So we just about squeezed it in.
Would you just admit you're going off now to watch March Madness, that you've been co-opted by me with all this talk of American sports through the years, and you're going to go watch 16 straight games of college basketball? Just admit it.
I'll admit it when it's true.
I'll admit it when it's true.
I do want to... Yeah. Before we finish up, I do want to say that apologies if it seems like we're sort of quiet on Twitter these days or not responsive to comments. I have been taking a break from social media, so it's not personal. I've just been taking a break from all the noise that's going on. So I will get back to that as soon as I can over the next couple of weeks before the season ends. I'll be most active around the Derby, let's be honest. Right, James, Alan, thanks very much.
Yeah, take care.
And
thanks, guys.
Thanks to you for listening, and we shall chat to you next week. Until then, good luck.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Marc Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Marc.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.